Welcome to another edition of What the Hal. I'm Hal Eisner. And, you know, when I think about the 60s, and I do that a lot because that was a big decade for me, one of the things I think about is music. And when I think about the music of that decade, I think about the Beatles. You know, there was just nothing more special to me back then than that group. And there was so much about their music that was incredible. So I can't even begin to tell you how exciting it is when I had the opportunity to meet Chris Carter, who is to me the Beatles expert of Beatles experts. And we did a little interview and we visited, and then I had a chance to invite him onto this podcast. And timing was the only issue, because from the get-go, he wanted to do this podcast. And so here he is. So Chris Carter.
Yes, Beatle Hal.
He gave me a nickname, Beatle Chris. You know, when it comes to Beatles, you know, the guy that knows all about the Beatles is Chris Carter. And we'll talk about all kinds of things Carter during this podcast. I'm so glad you're here. You know, I've tried for several weeks to get you into the studio, and you're such a busy guy. You got a lot going on.
I've been working, literally, not to use a Beatle cliche, but 8 shows a week I do.
Can you sing it?
And you did this to me last time, Al.
I tried to get him to sing. He wouldn't do it to me.
But really, it's incredible. I do Breakfast with the Beatles Monday through Friday mornings on Sirius XM on the Beatles channel. And then I do the KLOS show, still on Sunday mornings, which has been on for 35 years here in Southern California, started by Deirdre O'Donoghue. And then I do 2 British Invasion shows just for kicks on the weekends in Little Steven's Underground Garage. So 8 shows.
It's an amazing thing. You've really kind of dominoed this into a great product. And you really have, you know, for those of us that love the Beatles, and I'm one of those, you certainly have captured our imagination. I want to talk about you, because you have quite a history yourself without the Beatles. You were a founding member of Dramarama.
Right.
And so you not only are a disc jockey, but you were also a musician.
Right.
All right, let's go back to the days of Dramarama. Actually, before we do that, I want everybody to hear a song from the group, and this is called
Anything, Anything. This was on our first album, and it's still, to this day, August 2018. It's still on the radio like 2 or 3 times every day here in Los Angeles on various stations.
What is the story behind this song, by the way?
It was a song we cut back in New Jersey where we started. It was on our first album, and it was just an album track. It was no big deal. We didn't release it as a single or anything like that. And a DJ on K-Rock here in Los Angeles named Rodney Bingenheimer found this album, and then he found this song, and he started to play it. And, you know, the powers that be at K-Rock, the music directors and the program directors, started getting requests for this song. Not just 1 or 2, hundreds of requests. And it became number 1 on K-Rock. And to this day, they still play it 3 times. They play it in the morning, in the afternoon, and at night. It still gets these requests. And it's, you know, from 1986, for God's sake.
Well, right here on this podcast, let's listen to Dramarama. Quite a song, and it's nice to have a legacy song, isn't it?
It is. It's interesting. Most people know the song, and they don't know the group a lot of the time. It's the way it is with that song.
What happened to Dramarama?
Dramarama were together from 1982 to 1994, when we broke up, made about 5 or 6 albums. And then VH1 had this series they did called Bands Reunited, where they would get bands back together that had broken up. And they did a bunch of different bands, and we were one of those bands, and they actually made you work hard. They not only did they make you get back together after being broken up and, you know, healing old wounds and all that, but they had you play a concert. So you had to practice and actually work at this thing. And we played a concert at the Roxy, and then the singer and two of the other guys said, you know, we should still be in Dramarama. We should keep this going. But I already had stuff going on. So I gave them my blessing, and they got a couple of new guys, and they occasionally play, and they play on some of these 80s shows and stuff like that. You can still find them.
How fun. How did you get, how did you become sort of this incredible walking encyclopedia of the Beatles?
Well, it didn't start with, well, I guess it did start with the Beatles, but then it progressed on. You know, you could ask me about David Bowie and I could give you the same amount
Clark
of knowledge.
Five, any of the British gurus.
I just knew a lot about music. I studied it. I was a geek. You know, I bought the records, read the magazines, read the books. Always, you know, it wasn't just a phase. You know, once I started till today, I still do it. So if you do that, you know, it's kind of like Bob Costas with sports. You know, you talk to the guy and you immediately know this guy knows what he's talking about, and he doesn't do it in a show-offy kind of way. He just gives you the information, and that's kind of the way I approach it. You know, you don't want to be too, hey, I know everything and you don't know, or, you know, that's, I hate guys like that. But it's good to have the knowledge and then present it in a way that's digestible.
Well, since you know everything there is to know about the Beatles, let me start by, how did the Beatles become such a phenom?
It was an interesting, well, it's all timing, Hal, as everything is in life. But you have to back it up. And the thing that they did that I always noticed just looking at it, you know, is that they did something that nobody else or few and far between in entertainment have ever done. And that was to be liked, loved, and revered by all different age groups at the same time. So here you have this band that like 7-year-olds like, right? They like the Beatles. And 17-year-olds also like the Beatles. Now, that in itself is, it doesn't normally happen because of, you know, kids' music, blah, blah. And then you had the adults who liked Michelle and liked, you know, In My Life. So you had this cross-section. And that didn't happen, say, with the Dave Clark Five. Dave Clark Five, kids, teenagers liked the Dave Clark Five, period. People in their 40s weren't listening to the Dave Clark Five.
Herman's Hermits.
Yeah, it was kids' music. Most of it was kids' music. Stones, you know, definitely appealed to a certain age group. And today, if you go see Paul McCartney in concert at any, you know, anywhere in the world, literally, you will find a family with a 9 and a 10-year-old, you know, kid singing along next to some guy with a tie-dyed shirt and big gray ponytail, you know, in his 70s singing along. And you don't see that at a Stones concert. You don't see little kids singing Sister Morphine at the Stones concert. You know what I mean? It's unique to the Beatles and Ringo and Paul.
You know, yeah. I remember as a kid when the Beatles came out. And I remember how incredibly powerful they were. The Ed Sullivan Show, and I got a ticket to go see their first movie. And I remember that it was a cutout. It was a yellow ticket, and they were on the left side of the ticket, a big picture of them. And then their heads were kind of cut out in the ticket. And it was just like this, like, this isn't what a movie ticket looks like.
Right.
You know.
And even with their first film, just, and you know, the other thing we didn't really get to the depth of it was why. Why did the 7-year-old, the 17-year-old?
Yeah, why?
Because the music was so damn good. And that's really the essence of it all. Their songs were so great, so timeless, so unique to themselves, you know, that was the repercussion. That's what happened. You got this cross-section of people. And that wasn't just in America, too. We're talking about a 7-year-old in Australia and a 27-year-old in Australia. All over the you know, the world, this was happening virtually at the same time. And then they did what no other entertainers really had done, was they drastically changed mid-course. All the time they would change. And the reason they did this, Paul explained once early on, and he said, all the groups we liked, all the artists we liked, if it was Chuck Berry or Elvis or whatever, you'd buy their first record and you loved it. And then you bought their second record and you loved it, but not as much as the first one because it was kind of like the same. And then by the third record, they were still doing the same thing they were doing on their first record, and we lost interest. So what the Beatles would do is they'd give you this mop top thing, and all of a sudden in 1964 they put out, you know, Beatles for Sale, and they were doing like Dylan kind of stuff, and then Rubber Soul was completely different. And then when you get to Revolver, you know, Tomorrow Never Knows, this crazy stuff. This is only 3 years after I Want to Hold Your Hand. Same guys. So that's what they did. They grew with the audience. That was another clever idea, because they realized, hey, this kid who's nine in 1964, you know, he's going to be...
Well, was it them, though, or was it their management?
No, it was them. The management always followed what they did, except for the very beginning when, you know, Brian made him clean
Brian
up
Epstein.
And wear some suits and stuff like that. Right. Brian was great for them to get their foot in their door, but once the foot was in the door, it was up to the Beatles to keep it, you know, opened.
One of the reasons that we even started talking recently was because about a half century ago, they were here in Hollywood. They released an album, and they held a news conference at the Capitol Records building. And instead of talking about the album, everybody wanted to talk about the controversial comment that John Lennon had made, which was, we're more popular than Jesus. Now, up to that point, they hadn't really gotten overly political, had they?
Oh, no.
I don't remember them being overly political.
No, that was one of the, you know, cardinal sins of show business at the time. Well, you know, you would never do that because, you know, and Johnny Carson always said it so well, you know, why lose half your audience? You know, if you get political or if you're going to take a stand, not with general stuff, but in a certain regard, you know. And, you know, Brian, I'm sure, instilled that in the lads as well. And they were pretty much prohibited. You know, they were told not to do that up until 66. And then, you know, with Vietnam and things like that, they couldn't hold back because their generation was kind of speaking out against it. And they were the spokespeople, so to speak, for that generation. So they realized they had to say something. They just couldn't just walk around like, you know, innocent Beatles with tape on their mouth, you know.
Right. You know, for those who don't know, Brian Epstein was the manager. And what can you tell people about Brian Epstein? There are people probably listening that maybe never heard that name before.
Yeah, I mean, he was not a so-called manager per se. And what I mean by that, he had no managerial experience prior to managing the most successful act in the history of show business. So like the Beatles, you know, and sometimes when you look through past history, you'll always find that people that made the biggest impact in their genre had no experience there, and they kind of went in blindly, and that maybe was why they were so successful, because they really didn't use an old blueprint of how to do things, you know, like these old managers. And Brian was very unique in that respect. I mean, he had them playing at Shea Stadium. Think about that, in 1965, August 15th this week. You know, no, forget rock group, nobody. Frank Sinatra, they were stars before the Beatles, you know. Elvis didn't play no Shea Stadium, you know what I mean? So he was very...
I don't think Frank Sinatra did
no,
either.
No, nobody did. Yeah. You know, they never played, no one ever thought to put somebody in a sports arena. It just didn't jive. It wasn't showbiz, you know.
We're gonna hopscotch around a little bit, but I want to go back in time to when I was probably maybe... God, how old was I? I was a little guy. And my mom took me to a department store and let me buy a record. And it was the first record that she was going to buy me. And I wanted the Beatles. And I think I told you this story maybe.
Well, yeah, because my mom did the same thing for me. So it's very similar.
But what happened was that I had a choice. I could get one record. And I liked I Want to Hold Your Hand. And I liked She Loves You. But they weren't on... both on the same album.
Right.
And so I had to make a choice, and I bought the single, She Loves You, when I should have bought the album, in which every single song in Meet the Beatles became, what, platinum, titanium?
And Mom saved $2.19,
yeah,
too.
Jeez. Pretty much.
It was a good move.
Yeah. I love the song. And that's the thing. That's the thing I think.
Was that your first record ever?
I don't know that it was my first record, but it was the first one I bought.
Right.
I mean,
do you remember your first album? Do you remember your first album?
I know I liked the Four Seasons back then. I know from Jersey where you came up. I know that there were groups back then that I enjoyed a lot. I even liked, what was her name, Brenda Lee.
Sure.
Pretty good singers back then. But I wasn't
we're
one
seeing
that,
how old Hal is.
Yeah, we're working on this. I'll tell you, everybody. You know what? When I started coming up, I think the president was a guy named Fred Flintstone, but
there
I don't exactly remember. Boom, we're here 24 hours a day. Anyway, so I remember really enjoying playing that song over and over and over and over again. And that's really what happens to me. I hear something I like and I play it over and over and over again. And I just sort of was constantly drilling down on Beatles music. It was just, and a lot of kids were probably that way too. They just had a certain, I don't know, maybe the word's not innocence, but they just had a certain thing about them that seemed very different than everybody else.
And at the time too, you got to remember, when you're listening to music at the time it's released, you're caught up. You know, when a record is climbing the charts, so to speak, you don't literally see it climbing the charts unless you really look at the charts every week. But you hear it more and more and more, and your friends hear it, and it becomes a thing, you know. And that was very much the thing back then. It's hard to realize now when you have, 130 different genres of music you can listen to. Well, I like hip-hop, and I like speed metal, and I like country, and I like alt-country. And I mean, it's insane. Back then, it was like rock and roll. That was it.
Yeah.
You were a kid. You listened to one kind of music. I always say that about the Woodstock era. You know, everybody in 1969, if you were 18, 17, 16, you liked the same bands. You were just – it was a big, big group of the same mindset. You liked Hendrix. You liked Crosby, Stills.
My first concert was Hendrix.
You just liked it. You couldn't not like him.
Yeah.
Now, again, you know, my daughter is 16, right? She has 10 friends over. 10 different kids like 10 different kind of music. You know what I mean? Yeah. They didn't all have the same, right? Which is kind of sad. I liked it better when everybody thought, you know, it made the music, it made your generation more united, you know. Everybody is splintered off, just like the whole country is. Everybody is splintered, you know. There's no unity anymore. Everybody's their own thing, you know.
Back then, it was Pleasantville.
You didn't think it was, but now looking back, it was more than you thought, you know. I mean, the parents were freaking out in 69 with the hippies and everything. It was such a culture shock. But looking back, it seems so much more innocent.
You know, when you go back and you divide the Beatles into certain eras, early Beatles, let's start there. What was their greatest, most impactful song?
Well, you know, they were She Loves You and I Want to Hold Your Hand. Those were the two. You know, it was like the double shot. I Want to Hold Your Hand here in America. That was like the first, you know, real Capitol Records single by the Beatles, you know. But She Loves You, you know, that was really big in England. And you got to remember, they also put out a few records that didn't go right to the number one spot when they first, you know, Love Me Do. And, you know,
I like that song.
It was great, but it wasn't, you know.
Love Me Do.
Took a bit. There you go. Hal will sing it.
I'll sing, you know.
And, so that was, you know, because that was really the three words that got. Around the world.
Yeah, that was amazing. That
because it was so
like
unique
so...
for singing, you know. For a song to put like slang in it, you know. Even then, that was like very. I mean, you got to remember we're coming off a 61, 62, and 63, where everything was so homogenized. They after Elvis and all the crazy stuff from 57 and 58. Scared the daylights out of the adults, you know. I mean, Jerry Lee, those guys were really wild. I mean, you look at Jerry Lee Lewis, you look at some of those clips, you know, his hair is down in his face and he's kicking the piano. I mean, those guys were, whoa, that was wild, you know. And they just put the kibosh on that and gave you Pat Boone and stuff. So, you know, when the Beatles came along, there was this new sense of, you know, a little bit of danger there, even though they were so likable. You know, they were likable, but with a little wink in their eye. You know, that was the other thing about the Beatles. There was that humor, that sarcasm.
That wink in the eye, Hard Day's Night, that sort of thing.
And believe me, the comedy and the fact that they were funny. And the Beatles, if you also notice, never talked about music. Like, if you look at their interviews from like 64, 60, they never talk about like, well, you know, we're really into this acoustic thing. They would just make jokes and be very lighthearted. They would never get into their craft, which was also, you know, today, you know, Bono and The Edge will spend 10 hours telling you how brilliant they are, you know. Well, we did this and then we did this and we took that over there and we called Eno and he came. You know, the Beatles never did that. They never let the cat out of the bag. They never told you how they did it. They didn't want to tell you that. They just told you had a nice tie.
Yeah, nice tie. You started liking the Beatles when Mom bought your first record?
Rubber Soul was my first album, and we bought it at ShopRite, which was a food store. But, you know, they always had the albums. You know, they always had albums. Just like now, you can go to Whole Foods and you can buy Sgt. Pepper next to the broccoli. But, yeah, it was Rubber Soul, you know, $3.19, and it didn't have any hits on it. I mean, it was just, I didn't know what this record was. I just knew it was the Beatles and I should buy it, and I was seven. And to this day, I mean, when I hear those songs, when I'm even on the radio on a Sunday morning, I go right back to that. You know, sitting in my rec room, you know, with my father's big speakers and this garage turntable and listening to that record. I mean, it's funny how your brain works.
So you got into radio. How old were you when you got into radio?
Radio, well, let's see. I went to the Connecticut School of Broadcasting, by the way. If you grew up on the East Coast and listened to rock and roll radio, I used to have commercials for the Connecticut School of Broadcasting all the time. So I went there because I really did want to be a DJ. And it was very interesting because it was all kids from Long Island, so everybody talked, you know, like this. So they would teach you how to speak, you know. So they had, like, Marv Albert would come in and talk to the kids. And Imus was one of the teachers. They had cool, like, people coming in, you know. And then I got into then I owned a record store, and that's where I started Dramarama, in the basement of the record store. And in being in the band, we would do radio all the time, so you'd constantly be going, you know, to radio stations, and that kept my interest in radio going. And then when that guy who discovered us, Rodney Bingenheimer on K-Rock, would go on vacation, I would fill in for him on K-Rock, and then I just kept it going. And then I got the gig at the Beatles.
My early days in radio, I started at 16. So that was back in the 60s, 66, basically.
And at that point, the golden age.
It was a golden age. I mean, you know, we talked about bubblegum music, but it really was a great time and with great music.
Fantastic.
It really was.
And 66 could be one of the best years of all time for music, you know. 66, 67.
What happened to the Beatles in 1966? Because there was a real change for them.
Well, they stopped touring. That was, you know, you got to remember, that was, it was killing them because it wasn't any fun and it made no sense because, you know, what they should have done back in those days, but they never, this is something that Brian just probably never even thought about. But, you know, if you would have put the Beatles in theaters, right, like in 65, and instead of, you know, these massive, ridiculous stadiums, you know, they'd go to Cleveland and play the Enormo Dome, and it was ridiculous. They couldn't hear on stage. They had no amps. I mean, they would use the sound systems they used for the baseball game. So, you know, the guy would go, you know, up next, you know, and that would be the same thing the Beatles would be singing out of, like out of these little crappy speakers. So the whole thing was stupid. But, I mean, what if Brian had said, you know what, we're gonna really show the audience how talented these guys are. We're going to put them in a theater, you know, a nice 2,500 seat theater. That would have been great. Could you imagine going to see the Beatles in a more respectable venue where people weren't like hanging from the rafters? So it got so crazy for them, they quit. And your question was 1966. And once they, you know, and the reason they quit, I also think, is because they realized that they weren't the greatest rock and roll band in the world at the time. Okay, there were other bands kicking ass in 1966. If you went and saw them, you know, go see the Animals. There were certain bands that were real musicians. These guys were really, not that the Beatles weren't, but they didn't have to contend with the crazy screaming, and they could express themselves musically. You know, and these bands from San Francisco, these jam bands were coming out. You know, Jefferson Airplane and the Dead, and it was a whole nother trip. So the Beatles, I think they said, let's get out of this live thing because we're not the best of it, and these other bands are coming up. Let's just be the best at what we are, and that is making records in the studio. And then you got Sgt. Pepper. And that was their little, you know, to this is what we really do. We're going to make records, and we'll be the best in the world. And then they were. That's when they became, you got to remember, before Sgt. Pepper, the critics were like, these Beatles, man, I think this could be it. They quit touring. You know, Revolver came out. They didn't play any songs from Revolver live. It was like, things are, you know, we don't see a bright future for the Beatles with this Jesus thing. The whole thing was, look, you know, they were burning records. It was a dark time. All while they were doing, in their minds, they knew they were doing Sgt. Pepper. So they were going to come out and just, and they did. And then after that, they got the respect with people that never respected them. Leonard Bernstein, you know, people in the New York Times, people, you know, writing op-eds on the brilliance of this Baroque pop music created by these
Baroque pop music.
You know,
yeah.
These geniuses from Liverpool. All of a sudden, they were, you know. And that was, again, on there and had nothing to do with Brian. Brian was completely out of the picture pretty much at that point. So that was Paul McCartney and John Lennon. Not even George and Ringo. They kind of went for that ride. You know, John and Paul saying, we're going to go and deliver.
Well, these guys, they wrote the music. You know, occasionally yeah. There was a song the Ringo and George did, but right. They were really the power.
And you got to remember,
writers,
too, I mean. They were always imitating. In the beginning, they were imitating their idols. You know, they were imitating
Elvis,
and they went from imitating music to creating music. They invented a new sound instead of finally, you know, instead of just borrowing. They created a new music.
But who was it? Elvis and Chuck Berry?
Yeah, I mean, when you listen to the first Beatles record, you give those nods to Buddy Holly and Chuck
right.
Berry and Little Richard, and they're the first to tell you. And they were covering those songs, and you could hear the influences in their songs. It was obvious. And they would tell you, oh, that was us doing Chuck Berry. That's us doing Elvis. You know, no kidding, because they were just starting writing. But then, again, they went from imitating to creating, and that's where they got into that new league that they never even were in prior to Sgt. Pepper.
What was the first concert you saw with the Beatles? Dodger Stadium?
I didn't see Dodger Stadium.
You never saw Dodger Stadium?
No, because I was five and living in New Jersey then.
Yeah. Did you ever get to see them perform?
No.
Never did?
No.
Yeah.
No.
I never did either.
No, I mean, you wouldn't have. Problem is, you know, they stopped in 66, so they made it, you know, they were around for another 4 years, but they just didn't tour, so no one got to see them. Maybe you would have gotten the opportunity later, but they just didn't play.
What was the breakup all about? How long did that kind of, like, foment until it just, like, fell apart?
Well, you know, they talk about it differently, but if you just kind of look and listen to what was going on. It was never as bad as they make it seem. You know, they always say the White Album was this horrible summer of 68 was the White Album. And they really were fighting a lot then because John was on drugs and Yoko was involved. And it was really, that was the darkest time. Then they did Let It Be after that, which was January 69. And as much as that was not, you know, they say, well, there's this big fight between Paul and George. They said, you know, if you don't want me to play, I won't play. Okay, thank you. That's the fight. It's like, you know, I have worse fights with my wife every morning, you know, over, you know, the silliest things. And this was not a fight, you know. So Let It Be was, you know, filmed and everything. And everybody thought that was the, you know. But then they made Abbey Road, which is, in a lot of people's minds, the greatest Beatles album ever. And they worked hard together. They did, you know, 7-hour, 3-part harmony vocal sessions, which they hadn't done since the first record. They hadn't been that close. So creating this legacy, this last piece of music, they knew they were, this was it, you know, no matter what you hear. Because they ended it with the end. I mean, it was the greatest ending of a career, if you think about it. And it ended right at the end of the 1960s, 1969. They were perfectly of their time, you know, of that decade. They started and they ended it, and they ended with the end, and they gave you this great record. So, you know, I think it was pretty planned out. John knew he was gone. You got to remember, when Abbey Road came out in September of 1969, John Lennon had made 3 solo albums already. You know, I mean, people forget that. Give Peace a Chance had been out in that summer. So they were going their own ways, but it wasn't official. And I think when Paul made it official by putting it in a newspaper headline, the other 3 had been silent. They had never said anything. They had been still keeping up So I think that's really what made the whole thing ugly at the end, because then they became at odds after that.
And all of us wanted them to stay together.
Of course, you know, girls were crying in the streets. I mean, it was, you know.
It was sad.
I mean, people couldn't believe it. But it was that headline that made it official. And that's what got under John's skin. You know, John was like, oh, geez, you know, we all knew we were breaking up, but we were going to let it ride. And, you know, in typical Beatle way, no one was going to say anything or talk about it and just kind of knew. And Paul, by doing that, you know, made the other three always together and him separate.
If you break them apart, John, over that decade, really changed so much. I mean, even just physically, you look at his face, you just look at the way he changed and how his music reflected those changes that he was making.
Well, he was never content. He was never settled in his personal life. You know, he was on this ride with the Beatles, and then finally, you know, when he was putting these records out in 69 with Yoko and all these, you know, experimental things and nude album covers and showing up in bags and all this kind of stuff. That was his personal, you know, issues all coming. You know, he's going to shock therapy in California, you know, with Arthur Janoff, you know, for screaming and all that kind of stuff. So he was just trying to find himself. Paul's the same guy as he was in 1965.
He's never changed.
No, he's the same guy. He's settled. He knows who he is. He came from even though his mom passed away early, he came from a very together family. I mean, John's family life was, you know, chaotic, you know. And that's why you see that. You see it coming out in their personalities.
George,
same with George.
George was sad, too, when he died of a brain tumor.
Oh, well,
that was terrible.
Unbelievable. Yeah, that was... And a lot of people forget, too, George beat cancer. He had the cancer, and then he beat it, and then that guy broke into his house and stabbed him 14 times. A lot of people don't realize George Harrison, he was stabbed 14 times by this guy. And then, you know, 3 months later, he had cancer again. And I'm telling you that, you know, there's got to be something said about the shock that your body is going through. You're stabbed 14 times. You think you're going to die. Some dude's in your house. And he's protecting his wife. His wife hit the guy with the lamp. I mean, it was unbelievable. And that kind of, you saw it on the news one day. You're like, George Harrison's, you know, an intruder into his house. You didn't realize the extent.
I don't even think I realized.
He had this castle. He's this beautiful castle that he lives in. And this guy breaks into the castle at 4 a.m. and his wife and, you know, kid in the house. And George is fending him off. And, you know, you're shocked it's 4 a.m. And then to be stabbed and then still fight through it. It was a horrible ordeal. And the next thing you know, I'm not saying it could, but I mean, it sure must have had something to do with it.
And then the cancer's back.
Yeah, the cancer's back with the stress. I mean, you know, your body went through like hell.
You have to wonder. I mean, it's just, you know, you're right. I think there's something to be said for stress and impact. And then Ringo. Ringo just kind of goes on and on and on.
Ringo has been our guest on Breakfast with the Beatles more than any other person. Ringo's been on, I think, like 15 times.
What's he like?
He's, I've learned how to talk to Ringo, you know. You just, the leadoff always works for me is, Ringo, you look fantastic. What did you eat today? And he'll say, oh, I had some broccoli. Oh, God. He loves to talk about like food, and he's so healthy. You know, he eats broccoli and, you know, I got my baked potato and my broccoli. And if you want to get, you know, get on Ringo's wrong side, just say like, hey, have you heard Paul's new album? You know, I don't know. Have you heard Paul's new album? You know, he'll give you that, you know, or don't lead off with a Beatles question, you know, like, what's your favorite? You know, just talk to Ringo, because he's got a new record, and that's why he's there. So, you know, you got to, and then maybe 10 minutes later, you slip your Beatles question in there.
Yeah, he never ages. He doesn't
he
seem
looks
to
fantastic.
Age.
He and Paul both, you know. And you
got. Yeah, Paul's what, and 72?
77.
Yeah. 77? Yeah, he got past Ringo when turned 64, 70, didn't he?
Yeah. Oh, well, Paul's 76, Ringo's 78. Oh, Paul's 77? 76, I think, this year.
Is that what it is?
Ringo's 78. I know last year he was 77 because I gave him the soundtrack to 77 Sunset Strip and had 77 on it.
Oh, that's cool.
77. He carried it around.
How do you like that?
He loved it.
Yeah, that's great. Did you ever get to meet Paul?
Oh, yeah. I've had Paul on. Paul's been on 5 or 6 times. I interviewed all the Beatles except for John.
So
I interviewed Pete Best, so I get to say I interviewed 4 Beatles.
Yeah. He was the 5th Beatle, right?
Yeah.
Tell that story.
Well, Pete Best, you know, he, if you think about it, it's an interesting little fun fact. Pete Best played more time on stage with the Beatles than Ringo. Because Ringo, when Ringo joined the Beatles, you know, aside from the Cavern Club, which were, you know, pretty long sets, the Beatles concerts were 22 minutes long. I mean, you'd look, you know, it was over before you know it. And Pete Best, he played on those 8-hour German shows at Hamburg. They would play 8-hour shows, literally. They'd start at 8 at night and they played till 6 in the morning. It was on. So Pete Best put in more time on stage with the Beatles than Ringo did. And Ringo only had the few years, too. By 66, he stopped playing, so, you know.
But they keep pumping out songs and music and things, you know. They don't stop.
Pete Best is still around. You know, Pete Best's brother, Rogue Best, which is an interesting story in the Peyton Place aspect of the Beatles world. Beatles had a guy named Neil Aspinall, who was their right-hand man. He ended up running Apple Records, but he was like their side man, you know. There was Brian, and then there was Neil Aspinall. And Neil Aspinall had an affair with Pete Best's mother. And they had a son, Rogue Best. And for years, no one ever knew Rogue Best was Neil Aspinall's. And then when they did the anthology series, remember when they did the anthology series, when they did Free as a Bird and everything? Neil Aspinall was the producer of that because he ran Apple. And all of a sudden, he put 2 Pete Best songs on the anthology. And this was the first time Pete Best had ever been, you could hear a Pete Best track with the Beatles on a CD, because nothing Pete Best ever did came out because he was before there. So Pete Best made $1 million off the anthology because Neil put him on there because his mother was his, you know. So that's how the story
kind of,
it's a very interesting story. So Rogue Best just started a Beatles museum in Liverpool, and he's very active in the Beatles community. And Pete Best is still around playing drums. And another fun fact about Pete Best, who was fired by Brian, he had never, and still has to this day, never spoken to any of the Beatles since he was fired. And all these years, Ringo, Paul, nobody ever called the guy up and said, hey, Pete, sorry about that firing. You know, I mean, they never have talked to him to this day. And when Neil Aspinall died a few years ago, everybody went to the funeral, and Paul and Ringo didn't go because they knew Pete Best would be there. They had a special screening, and Paul and Ringo went because they didn't want to run into Pete.
Oh,
they
goodness.
Still feel like, oh, you know.
What's... You do breakfast with the Beatles at a restaurant in Seal Beach?
Once a month, and once from Morongo Casino a month.
What's that like?
Well, it's fun because you get to see all the listeners, and, you know, they don't know what you look like a lot of time unless they come back. And it's very, it's fun because, you know, in radio, you're alone in a room, you know, and you don't know, you know, other than a few phone calls, what the audience is like. And just like we were saying about the Beatles concerts, it's the same trip. There's families, and I'll look at these kids with their Yellow Submarine t-shirts, and they're 7, 8, and 9, and these kids, Hal, they know every word. And it's not just the hits. You know, you play Rocky Raccoon or something. These kids know it, and their fathers and mothers, we listen every Sunday. I hear it over and over. We listen every Sunday for 10 years. We've been listening for 20 years. We've been listening. It's like a family thing. And, you know, radio these days is not what it used to be. The fact that there's families listening to the radio in their home, you know, because everybody listens in their car. Just the fact that someone has a radio in their house blows my mind.
How many people do you get down there for this?
I think about, at Kobe, it's always sold out, but it's like, I think 150, and then Morongo's about 250.
So if people want to go to that.
It's booked for like 6 months.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It's crazy.
That must be pretty good feeling.
It's nice. It's nice. And I always say it's all about the Beatles. You know, I just carry the torch.
It had nothing,
you know,
to do with Chris Carter.
Well, you know, I keep them entertained, but they're there. We're all there for the same reason.
I think you're a very entertaining guy. I can understand exactly why people would want to come.
We try to have fun, you know, for sure.
You know, for those who don't know, I was at Chris's house and did a little interview with him there. And quite the crib. How do you describe that place you have? It's like an old garage, right?
It was a garage. I've turned it into, you know, it's eye candy. It's this visual experience. And, you know, when you first walk in, it looks like it's a little chaotic. But if you take a closer look, it's all very neat and, you know,
I didn't want to leave.
Precise. Yeah, guys of a certain age group seem to enjoy it more. It's just like a little pop culture museum of the 60s and 70s.
And it's filled with Beatles dolls and record covers.
Pictures
and anything you can imagine. It is just decorated in Beatles.
It's and you know, other. There's
you
have
some other stuff there,
we got
too.
Some
yeah.
James Bond stuff. We got some cool stuff from the 60s.
Yeah. British Invasion is a big part of your life. It's not just the Beatles.
Yeah.
It's dealing with these other groups. And you've actually had shows with just British Invasion music.
I do a show called Chris Carter's British Invasion every weekend in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Little Steven Van Zandt's sidekick, of course, to Bruce Springsteen and member of the Sopranos cast of characters. It's like being on The Sopranos minus the crime. That's what it's like to work with Little Steven Van Zandt. There's literally no difference at all than The Sopranos, only no one's getting knocked off.
I guess there are a couple of things that strike me. One, as somebody who's been a disc jockey in radio for decades, for a very long time, you've seen this medium change. And do you feel it's changed for the better? I mean, for me, I really like old radio. It was sort of like my first entry into broadcasting before I got to television.
Right.
And I've always had this sort of, you know, sort of love affair with radio. But it's changed so much.
Well, it's a lot. For a lot of us, it's how we got into music was via radio. So that was the first experience with radio. And then there's different aspects of radio. I mean, I used to listen to Gene Shepherd. You know, I used to listen to a guy talk all night long when I was, you know, 12 years old under the covers. There's a certain charm about that, you know, especially when I grew up in New Jersey and we used to get Chicago radio stations at certain nights of the week, you know, if it was just right. And there was something really fun about that, you know, just hearing stuff from other states and they're in a different time zone than you.
But it was the personalities, too. Yeah, it was the personalities.
And that was what you were seeking out, of course. But the whole thing about that came with it.
Yeah.
You know, along with the entertaining substance of what the guy was saying. It was just the whole form of radio, the fact that you can go to another station or something completely different and just move down the dial, you know. Didn't have a lot of stuff then. You had you had so many TV channels and that was it. Now, you know, you got 400 cable channels and you go over to Sirius XM radio and literally there's over 300 channels on there. And, you know, once you get into the music, then you got 60s, 70s, 50s, 40s, then you got deep tracks, classic vinyl, Beatles, Elvis, Springsteen. It's just incredible. You know, just then it goes into the different genres of heavy metal, which is like 15. It's like you don't even know these things exist.
Watercolors and this channel channel.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. The rainbow channel, the unicorn channel. Yeah, it's crazy. So then it gets diluted, and then, you know, there's the world of podcasts, which I guess in radio is the newest thing because, you know, there's and I'm not quite sure. You could probably tell me a few things about podcasts. I don't understand how they work. Do people get paid? Like, can you get paid from a podcast?
There's a way to monetize these things.
Like, how do these guys that have these podcasts make money?
Well, I guess they advertise. I mean, I do this through Fox 11 here in Los Angeles, so I'm
well,
not.
You're different. I'm famous. You're famous.
I'm not as famous as you are.
No. Are you kidding? You're a legend. but what I'm saying is, these guys that do these podcasts, like Adam Carolla, right?
Yeah.
Okay, he was a guy. He was on radio. Then he's not on radio. He has a podcast. I hear. Okay, so he must make money from this podcast. I would imagine he has listeners that he brings over. Do you guys know how that happens?
I don't personally know, but I know that our digital director here at Fox 11, a fellow named Patrick O'Brien, probably let you know after we do this broadcast.
I was just curious about it because
must be ways to do that. I'm sure there are ways to do that.
I mean, I'm sure people do it just to have their podcast and they're not looking to make money, but I figured guy like that, you know, these other guys that are successful that are having podcasts, I would figure.
Why don't you have a podcast?
Are you kidding me? I have time. Doing this is like the big thing of my week. I got out of the house.
I'm so jazzed that you're here. I want to ask you also, to sort of wrap up the Beatles part of this, what is the greatest contribution of these four guys?
Oh, it's simply the music, the fact that you have this music at your fingertips for the rest of existence on the planet. That's it. You know, everything else, you know, all the movies, the interviews, the fun stuff, all that stuff is all just icing on the cake. You know, what they left us is the music, and that's, you know, it's timeless and it's always going to be there, which is fantastic.
And what's ahead for Chris Carter?
I'm going to take a nap when I go home. Oh, just more. You know, I am so into this now, Hal, because I get to do it every day. And all the ideas, you know, I would come up with a show every week. You know, I would really put a lot of thought into it. But now, you know, it's got to be rapid fire. So it really keeps me on my toes. And I get to, I think I feel more alive now because I really am taking each day, you know, as a new day. I have to look at the date and see, okay, it's August 15th. Like, you know, I'm doing today. Okay, August 15th. What happened on August 15th? Oh, like, I'll be surprised because I'll say, oh, 65, Shea Stadium was August 15th. So that gives me a whole, you know, empty canvas to do this show I'm going to do tomorrow. Oh, Shea Stadium. All right, what I'll do is I'll, and then I looked and I saw that the Cavern Club, they played the Cavern Club on the same day, August 15th in 1962. Wow, what a mind blower. Here they were at this little dumpy bar. 3 years later, they were at Shea Stadium. Same guys playing the same songs. What a contrast! And then I do that bit on the show. Just like I kind of got excited looking at that, and then I share that with them. How you do a show.
You have this incredible energy. You do. You have this incredible energy.
Well, because it excites you because you like it. You know, it's like if you like something, if you whatever it is you love, if somebody shows you something new about something you love, your instant, you know, reaction would be whatever it is, and you know.
Well, I love the idea that you gave me a name, Beatle Hal.
Beatle Hal. That's gonna
like
stay
that
with you forever, Hal.
And you're Beatle Chris.
That's right.
Yeah, and so what the hell, you know?
What the hell?
That's how we have to end this, right? Are you ready?
That's right. I said that when he first texted me. I said, "What the hell?"
He knew I
was a kindred spirit.
So I guess we got to end the show that way, right?
What the hell?
What the hell? I can't tell you how much I appreciated the chance to talk with Chris Carter. Great guy. Really, really a nice guy. And if you haven't already subscribed to this podcast, What the Hell, please do. You can do it on iTunes, Google Play, any of the podcast platforms. And if you get a second and you want to give us 5 stars, that would be nice. And maybe leave a little comment or just leave a comment, whatever your feelings are. But the bottom line is, thanks for being with us. And we'll see you next time on What the Hell.